the fifth kind.
The ancient texts of India talk about very advanced technology. They talk about flying machines or vimanas. They talk about test tube babies. They talk about genetic engineering. They talk about interstellar travel. We do have some strong evidence that Nagas were these reptilian beings, very powerful, and they're able to do things like shape-shifting, for example. They're able to transform and create illusions. They're capable of flight, and they usually live underground.
If you enjoy our content here on Fifth Kind TV and would like to support our work, please would you consider subscribing to our new website, fifthkind.tv. Here we will have our full catalogue of material, along with exclusive access to interviews and documentary content. Sign up today, become part of the community, become part of the conversation. Thank you so much for your support, and I'll see you there.
Praveen Mohan is known worldwide for his research into the symbology of ancient temples around the world. His archaeological and spiritual quest has taken him to Peru and Indonesia, but focuses chiefly on the ancient treasures to be found in India. He has guested on History Channel's Ancient Aliens and has built his own platform to some 4 million subscribers across 4 languages. Praveen Mohan, welcome to The Fifth Kind.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you with us today. I love your documentaries, and it's a real treat to be shown around places that most people will never get the opportunity of visiting. I was very fortunate to visit India some years ago and explore some of the temples, but you take us to some very interesting places. And on those journeys, you found suggestions of ancient technology, healing therapies, ancient knowledge of medicine, genetics, possible contact with other species, and hints of international and global culture from the deep past that seems to throw a question mark over what we think we know about history. We're going to touch on all of those things in our conversation today, but I thought it'd be interesting to start by asking you, what got you started? What was the thing that drew you into this fascinating field?
Well, the thing is, I had a very unique childhood. When I was a child, I grew up around temples, not just one temple. I grew up in multiple temples. So it was really a unique experience because I was 10 years old and I would be inside the temple for more than 6 hours every day. And I used to look at all the idols and statues. And you know the Hindu temples in India, they have hundreds of stone statues. So I would look at the statues, I would try to understand why they are carved in a certain way. And I distinctly remember one time there was a giant granite pillar lying on the floor. And it had an unfinished carving. It was a lingam and it was an unfinished carving. And I was only about 10 years old, so I thought I would go and finish the carving myself. So the next day I went back to the temple with an iron nail, thinking that I could just somehow finish the carving. And I realized I couldn't do it. The next day I went with a screwdriver, hoping that, you know, I could somehow use it as a chisel. And I realized that that didn't do it either. So after trying for about 2 weeks, I convinced myself it's not because I couldn't do it. It's because of the fact that the pillar was on the floor, right? So I thought maybe if I could put it up erect, I could finish the carving. So I couldn't move the pillar. After trying, I gave up. So I went back to school. I got a bunch of my friends who were all 10-year-olds. And then we tried to basically prop the pillar up, erect. And we realized how heavy it was. And as a young boy, I realized that, so what appears to be so simple is actually extremely complex. I'm not able to carve anything on this granite pillar, because granite is a very hard material. It's one of the hardest rocks in the world. And we also realized that if 10 boys could not move this pillar must be weighing in tons. It's not in kilograms or pounds. This pillar is weighing in tons. And then we started wondering, how did ancient builders cut these rocks from the quarries? How did they move these pillars to the temple site? And how did they carve on these granite rocks, right? It's not really that simple. And what we read in history books is that, okay, so people were using really primitive tools. They didn't even have hardened steel at that time, like the steel I was using, like the screwdriver I was using. So how did they carve these amazing things into these pillars? And how did they move these tons and tons of rocks? So I got exposed to this kind of idea very, very early in my childhood. And obviously that must have been sleeping inside for a very long time. And then maybe when I was like 25, it just, you know, something woke up that beast and I started to look at it again.
Oh, wonderful. Back when you were 10 and beginning to ask questions about what you're seeing in the temples, it sounds like you were in a very devout family to be in the temple sort of 6 days a week. Did you take your questions to your parents? Did they offer you any answers?
My parents simply dismissed these questions as just, you know, these are curious questions. He will get over it, right? That's what yes. people do to all the kids. Okay, he's just going through a phase. He will get over it, right? But yeah, I grew up in a family, in a Hindu family, which was really devout. So I had a chance to read all the ancient texts. So I read all the stories. And which is what really, you know, deepened my interest, right? Because the ancient texts of India talk about very advanced technology. They talk about flying machines or vimanas. They talk about test tube babies. They talk about genetic engineering. They talk about interstellar travel. They talk about time travel. So, it's very interesting. I mean, I think I had a very interesting childhood.
So at the age of 25, did you already know that there were these anomalous pieces of advanced information about interstellar travel, time travel, or was 25 the beginning of your journey to discovering that there were all these treasures?
When I was 25, I was in the United States. I was at 25, I think I was in Boston at that time, and I actually started to travel a lot. Initially, I traveled to, you know, the fun places. You know, I would probably go to like Cancun in Mexico and spend a weekend there partying. But later on, I started to go to the Mayan pyramids of Mexico, and I started to look at the structures. And then I went to Peru, and I went to places like Machu Picchu and Ollantaytambo. And then I started to connect that with my childhood ideas and realize that, okay, this is a global phenomenon, right? We don't have these giant megalithic structures only in India. We also have them in Mexico. We also have them in Peru. We definitely have them in Egypt. So I started to put these things together and realize that, okay, so there's something that we are not addressing here. We don't understand that fully. And it's all around the world. So when I was in the US until 2015, I focused more on South America and Central America. I looked at all those structures, and we have these giant mounds in the United States. So I did some documentaries about the Serpent Mound and the Alligator Mound and things like that. But then as I started to delve deeper and deeper into these ancient sites, I realized that no, in order for me to crack this code, I have to come back to India, because the most important detail and I don't know if you know this, is that all the Greeks are not worshiping Thor or Hercules anymore. The Egyptians are not worshiping Ra, right? Those gods are all gone. I mean, they've become superheroes sometimes in the modern day movies. But in India, we have 1 billion people who are still worshiping the same gods. And so we have that continuity. So when we go to Greece or when we go to Egypt, we can't ask the locals, what does this mean? What does this god mean? What kind of rituals are associated with the statue? Because that tradition is gone. But in India, we still have these temples, and all the locals go to these temples and still do certain type of ritual for certain gods. So I realized that if I come back to India, I could not only research the temples, I could also understand what these statues mean and how these locals have these stories connected to them.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm going to come back to rituals in temples a little later, but before we get there, I just wanted to ask if you could give us a survey of some of the sort of anomalies that you can find in terms of out of place
artifacts,
technology. Yeah, okay. Out of place technology portrayed in temples. And you can find it all around the world, but I'm particularly interested in what you found in India.
Okay. So we have a particular type of artifacts called oop art. These are called out of place artifacts. The classic example of this is the Antikythera mechanism, where they found a weird mechanism, but it's much, much older. That kind of a gear mechanism is not supposed to exist like 2,000, 5,000 years ago, but they found it. So, but in India, we also find these out of place carvings. For example, in Hoysaleswara Temple, which is a 850-year-old temple, you have a person holding up a telescope to one eye, closing the other eye, and looking at the sky. Such a carving is not supposed to exist because the telescope was invented much later than, you know, when the temple was built. It was the telescope was invented by Lippershey and Galileo much later. So we are not supposed to find carvings of a telescope. And then in Konark Sun Temple, you have a carving of a giraffe. And we see a bunch of people hanging out with the giraffe. And giraffes are only found in Africa. And we're not even talking about North Africa, like Egypt or something like that. We're talking about deep down in the south. So, but we do find carvings of the giraffe in India. So we have evidence of advanced civilizations around the world, which are somehow connected, and we're not able to put them together. In Hoysaleswara Temple, you have a carving of an Egyptian. It looks very much like an Egyptian. In another temple called the Brihadeeswara Temple, you have a carving of a European, okay, with a top hat. So all these evidences prove that, you know, we're not fully understanding these things, and these don't fit into the traditional history books, and these are all out-of-place artifacts. But the most important part about the technology is that we have evidence of these vimanas, or flying machines. We do see that they have these vimanas carved in ancient temples. Now, what does a vimana mean, right? A vimana is a flying machine very similar to an airplane, okay? And then there is also another vimana, which is very similar to a rocket or like a thing for space travel. Those are also called vimanas. The most popular one, which all Indians know about, is called a Pushpaka Vimana. This is mentioned in the ancient text called Ramayana, which is more than 2,000 years ago. And it clearly says that, okay, so there is a person who takes another person from India and he takes that person to Sri Lanka. Okay, this is through flight. So they're basically flying in air. And they even mention how they contact a bird in between when they fly. So this is very similar to how we travel to Sri Lanka. For example, I can travel from India to Sri Lanka in an hour. Like I would just go to the airport, take a flight and go there. So this kind of technology is mentioned clearly in ancient texts. And you can see them carved in ancient Indian temples. So you can actually see these carvings, which look like a small aircraft, looks very much like a microlight or an ultralight people fly today. And they're shown with wings. Sometimes they're shown with like strange accessories attached to them. Okay. So we can see evidence of these flying machines. And it's really interesting how our perspective is slowly changing. Because just 100 years ago, before the Wright brothers came in, people used to think that this is absolute nonsense, right? This is pure fantasy. How can something that's heavier than air fly in air, right? So people, especially Westerners who studied the Vimana and translated them into English, they said this was pure fiction. There's no such technology. This is all coming out of pure imagination. And in the last 100 years, people have started to question, is it possible that they had this kind of technology thousands of years ago? Now, yes. There's one more type of Vimana mentioned in ancient Indian texts, and this is even better, right? Because they're talking about interstellar travel. The texts often mention how the gods come from the sky using Vimanas. And just two decades ago, right, 20 years ago, before Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos started thinking about going to Mars and terraforming that place and start to colonize Mars for us to go and live there, people, again, thought this is just complete fiction. They just couldn't imagine that. But today, Elon Musk is planning to go to Mars. He's going to alter the surface of Mars. He's going to alter the atmosphere, right, for making it usable by humans, right? This is called terraforming, right? But the same technology is mentioned in ancient Indian texts. In Ramayana, there is a person called Trishanku, okay? So for this person, there were some people who went to another planet and created that planet suitable for him to go there and live. And again, you know, the text mentions that they went in a golden Vimana to that planet. So they were not only talking about the flying Vimanas and interstellar travel, but they were also talking about these advanced concepts like terraforming.
Yes. This is very interesting because there's quite a difference between how these accounts in the Vedas have been treated in India with how accounts of ancient technology have been treated in the Bible. And in my research, I've found lots of references to flying technology and interstellar technology in the Bible. But through the centuries before flight and our journeys into space, the translators tried to translate them as spiritual phenomena and didn't look on them as technology. Whereas with the Vedas, it's always been understood this was the flying technology of the gods, but it was disbelieved. When I went to India, I didn't know anything about the Vedas, but I could see the carvings on the buildings and I could see things that looked like turbines, that looked like jet engines, that looked like rockets, that looked like aircraft. And so I was full of questions as a young boy traveling around India. Now I've seen more than that. I've seen tablets that look like, you know, iPads or iPhones, medical devices, guns, bombs. When you ask the mainstream commentators about these devices now that we have this technology, is there more openness to the idea that the Vedas are describing real historical experiences and that these carvings are portraying things that were real material science in the deep past?
There's going to be a lot of reluctance and resistance from mainstream historians and archaeologists. Understandably so, right? Because they have studied their own materials and they had to get all their degrees and their masters and their doctorates reading the materials, right? Saying repeatedly, pounding into their heads, saying that, okay, so these temples were built with primitive technology. These things did not exist. Human beings evolved from apes. It was a very slow transition. We were all like primitive people until like 2,000, 3,000 years ago. So they've studied that from high school all the way up to their PhDs. And if they had to change their minds, I mean, what would happen to their jobs? So there's going to be a lot of resistance from them. We do see them, which is why I always take extra pains to, show the evidence as it is. There's still a lot of resistance, even when we show them, okay, so there is a carving that's holding something like a cell phone to its ear, right? So people, it's just there, whether you like it or not, that carving is still there in a 1,000-year-old temple. So, but people find it very hard to accept it because the evidence is right in your face. We don't know 100% if it's a cell phone, but that carving is there. Rather than accepting it that the statue exists, people try to discredit you, right? And I'm sure you face your own group of people who try to discredit you because when we put out evidence that goes against centuries of established institution type stuff, we're going to get a lot of people who are upset. That this is just the name of the game. But it's our duty to show the evidence.
When you show evidence like that, say the person using what looks like a cell phone, what's the usual response? Do the mainstream experts say, it looks like that, but it's something else? Do they say it's just imaginary technology? Do they tell you you're not seeing what you're seeing? What's the general approach?
We've seen a lot of different types of responses. In India, the responses tend to be more about your character rather than what the evidence is. It'd be simply like, oh, okay, Paul Wallace is not a good person type of stuff, rather than saying, okay, what he's showing is not right. So this is still the mentality in India. One great thing is that there are some people who look at the evidence and see it as evidence. We do still have at least like one third of the population who look at that evidence. If a person is holding something like a telescope to his eye and closing the other eye and looking at the sky, what else could it be?
Yes.
Right? So we have about one third of the people who actually say, okay, so this is real solid evidence. So it is possible that something like a telescope existed 900 years ago. That's the logical conclusion. But there's still like more than 50% of the people who, because see, it challenges what they've read for the last 25 to 50 years. That evidence is in your face, challenging whatever the ideas you have accumulated. Right. So it's very hard to face that kind of evidence because we all have confirmation bias. We'll just immediately switch over. You will either change the video because if you do face that evidence, if you do face that reality, then you have to change your own reality, which you have built for such a long time.
You do have, you're absolutely right, Praveen. And I think it really is the role of the writer or the documentary maker to push the conversation forward, because peer review will always keep people conservative. If people want to keep their tenure, they're not going to be the ones bringing the radical new ideas, but at least the academics can discuss what this crazy Praveen Mohan has said or this crazy Paul Wallace has said, and then you can move the conversation a little bit. But at least with the examples of the carved heritage that you look at, you've got a lot of support for what those things are in texts. So you have ancient texts that talk about flying craft. You have ancient texts that talk about gestation pods or terraforming, so that when you come to the carvings, it's not something you've just plucked out of the air to say, oh, this looks like that. You are saying this looks like what we have described in the texts. And in modern language, we would call it this. We would call it in vitro fertilization. We would call this a gestation pod. We would call this a flying craft, whatever it is. We would call this a surgical procedure. So there is that support there that should make it easier for some to come into the conversation and then ask the next question, was it real?
Yeah, I certainly think so.
I want to suggest also, you've found such wonderful treasures in your documentaries, and not only have you found portrayals of technology, but you've found actual pieces of technology. And one that I really enjoyed hearing you explain was the name of the temple, I think, is Chandi Kimpulan. And you found the buried remains of a piece of technology that appears to be for the purpose of generating electricity. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So we went to Indonesia about 3 months ago, and we were in Indonesia, in Central Java for about 3 weeks. And we were analyzing a couple of temples there. One of them is a small, nice little Hindu temple, and it has a very interesting story behind it. Actually, there is this great university called the Islamic University of Indonesia. And 20 years ago, they were trying to build a new library, and they started, you know, the construction workers started to dig for a foundation. But surprisingly, they found something buried inside. And when they started to dig those things up, a Hindu temple started to come out. And archaeologists confirmed that this temple is about 1,200 years ago. So this is a very ancient temple. And the archaeology report gets very, very interesting. So they had things buried under the base of the lingam, and they also had things buried between the lingam and the base. Now, what's really interesting is that I looked at the archaeology report. I started to recreate what they found in the temple. So they would say, okay, we found pieces of silver here. So I would go and buy pieces of silver. And they said, okay, they found like golden foils there. So I actually went there and got golden foils and iron and copper and all that stuff. Now, it's very, very interesting to me because the archaeology report done by the government of Indonesia actually says, we found a copper wire. This is strange because you don't see this kind of evidence, you know, coming out of other places. But they have clearly said, this is a copper wire. I mean, what else do you use a copper wire for? This is for electricity. So I started to put those things together, and I recreated the whole setup. I built a small little lingam. I built a pot, and the same pot was found in Chandi Kimpulan, and they filled it with husk, which was used as a placeholder for things. In India, we still use it. In India, if we want something to be held in place, we put husk and we pour water on top of it. So because it just holds it in that place forever, nothing happens to it. I mean, think about it. it's really interesting, right? Husk is organic, right? Mm-hmm. But it's still intact for 1,200 years in Indonesia, buried, right? Nothing happened to it. So it's some really interesting material. So I started to put those things together, and I put a silver plate and an iron plate in that husk, and I put it in that pot, and I put it in front of the lingam, and I poured water on top of the lingam, just like what any Hindu would do, even today. This is an ongoing practice. We always pour water on top of the lingam. And when we checked it with a voltmeter, we realized that this produces electricity. You know, the ions move from one metal to another, and we are producing more than 0.5 volts of electricity. And it was really shocking to me. And then I realized that these ancient boulders there were actually generating electricity, which is evident because I recreated the same setup, and they even had copper wires. But what did they use this electricity for? Were they lighting up light bulbs or like doing something else with it? But then I realized how Hindus do these rituals, right? They would put their hands in the pot, right? And then I started to go and read online about electrotherapy. It's very interesting because Benjamin Franklin, who is one of the founding fathers of the United States, also talks about a similar procedure. He called it the electric bath. So these people, again, use the same technology. They used two electrodes, and they just sent some low volt or low amp electricity into the water. And humans were supposed to put their hands, or if you had, for example, if you had pain in your feet, you just put your feet in that bathtub, right? And this is exactly what ancient Hindus were doing 1,200 years ago. Now, we don't know if they fully understood this, by the way, right? But what would, even in India, this is very common. If you come to India, if somebody has this, let's say he had chronic hand pain, right? So instead of going to the doctor and taking all the pills and getting all the side effects and all that stuff, these people actually go to these temples, and they pour water on the lingam, and they put their hands in that pot, right? Actually getting electrotherapy. And the thing is, all these, like, for example, if you go to a doctor today, if you go to a physiotherapist, he would be like, okay, come for like 12 sessions, come for 25 sessions. Like, you have to come for the next 25 days and get electrotherapy. But ancient Hindus masked it in the name of rituals. They'd be like, okay, you cannot miss even one day. You have to come here for the next 40 days and put your hand in this pot to get the healing power of the lingam.
So this is absolutely fascinating. I've had electrotherapy myself. Anyone who's read my books knows about all my injuries. And I've been to physiotherapists, and they've electrocuted different bits of me. And so I know this ritual from a Western perspective. This is what you do. We put this equipment on you. We'll just run it through you for the next 15 minutes. What's fascinating is that people had this pattern of going to temples. And I think very often we look at that pattern and we oversimplify what's happening. Oh, they're going to worship a deity. They're going to do some devotional act to a deity. But what you found there suggests they might be also going for healing rituals that they expect to be effective. Now, that whole scenario of the battery that you found, that didn't come together by accident. Somebody knew how to put that together. And I'm very intrigued. This date has come up a couple of times already in the conversation when you talk about the age of the temples, about 1,000 to 1,200 years ago. So at that time, it seems like somebody knew how to put one of those together that would have a healing effect. Even if they didn't have technological language for it, they knew how to construct it, and it was technology. So I've got a couple of questions here. People going to temples, are they going for lots of different things, including this kind of healing therapy? And where did the knowledge come from prior to 1200 years ago?
Yeah, well, today people go to temples for a variety of reasons. A lot of people just go there as a part of their daily or weekly routine. There are many devout Hindus. Like I said, we got like 1 billion pagans, if you will. From the Western perspective, we got 1 billion pagans still left who are actively involved in all these rituals. There are a lot of sick people who are going to get healed. There are a lot of quote unquote, like kind of mentally sick, like they're depressed. They might maybe going through some problems and they're going to the temples. And they usually follow a ritual that'll be like, okay, so if you come here and then, you know, worship this deity for the next 40 days, you'll be healed, right? Well, I mean, sometimes it's just common sense. If the person is obese and they'd be like, okay, just go to this temple on top of the mountain every day and then and then go around the temple for like 9 times. I mean,
you'll notice the difference.
I think it's just, it would probably what my fitness trainer would tell me, right? Just go on top of the mountain.
It makes sense.
Yeah. So a lot of this is also masked in the name of rituals. And it works better because even if your doctor tells you, you may skip a couple of sessions. But if you're really devout, you may not skip any session at all. So it works really well.
Yes.
So people go to these temples for a lot of reasons. We have understood some parts of it. Some of this is pure superstition. And don't think I'm just masking everything, saying that, okay, everything that these people are doing is right. I'm not saying that. I'm not at all saying that. There's definitely some superstition there, which may have been added on later in the past few centuries. But there is a lot of rituals which are also there, which actually help us a lot. Yes. The real problem is to separate both of them because we don't understand which one is helpful and which one is harming us. And that's where we are. India is having a lot of these beliefs and things. We don't know like what is what. And a lot of it is mentioned in ancient texts. A lot of it is also not mentioned in ancient texts.
So there's tradition that isn't written down, but that has been maintained nevertheless for a long time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Lots of traditions are not written down and we follow them. I mean, weird traditions, like it just really strange. The thing is like, we're not supposed to cut down trees. You know, this is really weird. Like the thing is, trees are gods for us, actually. So we're not actually supposed to cut down trees. From face value, it just seems really simple. Like, we're not supposed to cut down trees. Like, how do you make all the furniture and stuff like that? But until the last 50 years ago, when people didn't do it, when people thought that, okay, so trees are gods, let's not harm the gods kind of things. India was much, much greener. You know, but once we got like, quote unquote, civilized and said, OK, these are just trees, let's cut them. The deforestation was just going insane. The amount of deforestation, the amount of trees, because people just became completely reckless. Right. It must have been the belief that kept them on a leash because they just went completely nuts. And now the deforestation is just crazy. We lost a bunch of trees. We lost a significant portion of the trees in the last 50 years.
So it turns out there was a lot of sense in the ancient wisdom.
Yes.
And maybe the explanation had been short, but there was a lot of wisdom in it. I notice many of the temples you walk around, you are barefoot because they're considered sacred spaces. And then a couple I've noticed you wandering around in trainers. So what's happened to the temples where you're allowed to wear trainers? Are they not working temples anymore?
Yeah, so most of the times it's not something that's enforced by others. What I do is that when I go to a temple, I see if it is a living temple, meaning that is the main statue in the central chamber intact? Okay, if it's not intact, we don't have to, if it's destroyed, it's not a living temple. So I would probably put on my shoes and do all the research. Sometimes it's really hard. Most of the times I would remove my shoes. I'd like to do this almost in all temples, not to put my shoes on. Because I myself, I'm a Hindu, I'm a devout Hindu. And we also have a lot of people who are watching who are also devout Hindus. We certainly don't want to hurt their sentiments. But yeah. Sometimes the temples are, it's impossible not to wear shoes. A lot of people think, okay, go to Angkor Wat, but don't wear shoes. Angkor Wat is like three times the football field in the U.S., okay? It's like, it's bigger than the Vatican City, I think. Okay, so I'm not going to be walking for like the whole day without shoes, okay? So sometimes we use common sense. Sometimes we have to go on top of the temples. We try to restore them. Sometimes there are thorns. Sometimes there are, you know, like places that you do have to wear shoes. You know, the authorities say, look, in Indonesia, sometimes the authorities will say, look, you have to wear shoes and only then we'll let you in, right? It's like yes, no shoes, no service type of stuff.
Yes,
so sometimes
yes.
I do. Yeah, but mostly I don't like to put on my shoes. But if necessary, I will wear my shoes.
Yes. Something that crops up in sacred spaces around the world, cathedrals and temples alike, is cymatic patterns. And you can see them built into stained glass windows. You can see them designed as mandalas. And cymatic patterns, for anyone who doesn't know, are the patterns generated by sound waves. And you find them in Hindu temples. What is their meaning in that context? What is their function?
In ancient Hindu temples, in the ceilings, especially on top of the main deity, you'll see these large circular patterns, like elaborately carved with a variety of details. And each one is different. And I call them cymatic patterns. We don't actually have a real name for it. But the thing is, I think these are visual images of a certain sound. And we know that like everything that we talk about, like today we're talking and, you know, what we're basically doing is just throwing some sound and we're able to kind of translate that sound into meanings and then we're communicating between each other. But if we just take that pure sound and it can be represented visually and all the sounds that we say, all like the wind blowing or the mantras like Om that we use in Hinduism, everything comes to like a nice circular pattern with a lot of like designs inside. So we see these elaborate carvings and they look very similar. They look similar to propellers. They look similar to the Iron Man's arc reactor. But these are all cymatic patterns, but we're not able to reverse engineer that. We don't know what that visual we think that visual is a cymatic pattern of a specific sound, but we're not able to go back to that sound from that visual. Okay, we're able to do the opposite. I myself have a, I forgot the name of it. I myself have a machine where we actually chant the mantras, and it has like a, it's called a Kladni plate. That's what it's called. I have a plate and then I sprinkle some water, some salt on it. And then we chant the mantras in our group. And then we can see the cymatic patterns. Okay. So we're able to do the opposite. We're able to make these sounds and we're able to look at the visual representation of that sound. And now we have hooked it up to certain frequency devices and we put like a certain frequency and we're able to see how that frequency looks on the cladding plate. But we're not able to do the opposite. We're not able to see, okay, so this cymatic pattern on the ceiling corresponds to this mantra or this sound. We're not there yet. But maybe in the next 10 to 20 years, we'll be able to reverse engineer that and say, okay, so this temple is dedicated to this mantra, which means this. And that temple is dedicated to this mantra, which means that, okay? And in Hindu texts, this is what happens, right? So let's say you go there with like a chronic cold. They will give you a specific mantra to chant for a certain time. If you go there with depression, they'll give you a different mantra, right? So I think these temples were built for specific reasons. I think, for example, the sick people would go to a certain temple. The people who had like broken relationships all the time, they should go to another temple, this kind of stuff. Because the temples had that essence of that mantra in them.
Yes. I'm really interested to see where that kind of research goes, because I believe there are many sacred spaces in the East and the West that were really places for sound healing. And the spaces had been designed to resonate at particular frequencies or particular kinds of healing experience. It's just a speculation on my part, but I have been to places where you walk into the space and you think, I just want to stay here. There's something about the energy in this room that I just want to sit in. I'm sure you've had that experience as well with all the temples that you visited.
Yes. One thing about the real ancient temples, when I mean ancient in India, I'm specifically talking about temples which are older than, let's say, about 600 years, you know. So if you go to those temples, it's very hard for you to hold a negative thought. I've experimented with this. You could be having a bad day. You could be upset about somebody or something. And then when you enter the temple, you're still holding it. But as you go towards the central chamber, it just leaves you completely. And you can spend like an hour or 2 hours inside the temple and you just completely forget that negative thought. It's very hard for you to go and sit in a temple and like plan a murder. Like it's just impossible. Because I think this is fascinating because we don't understand how they achieved that. They must have achieved that with something else. You don't have to be a Hindu. You don't even have to be a theist. You can be an atheist, right? Yes. You don't have to believe in God. And if you still walk through that ancient Hindu temple, the modern Hindu temples have just dropped that concept. They don't know why they're building it, right? The modern Hindu temples have completely like not understood that. But in ancient Hindu temples, they put certain materials, for example, the walls were usually made of granite, but the central statue was never made of granite, never. So, and the walls and the outer chambers of the temple will have carvings and everything, but the inner chamber has nothing. It's just completely empty. And it's built of, and they built acoustics in a certain way. So as you're moving towards the central chamber, so you just slowly drop all your negative energy and you're going there, right? And they put a lot of things inside, and we have only understood some parts of this because they would do these elaborate rituals, right? They put like a giant lingam made of like shiny black rock, which they go to like the river Ganga, which is like far away, and they get this piece of rock and they polish it. But before planting it in the ground, they would put like gold and silver and like all the diamonds and everything inside. So they must have tried to do something there which we don't understand, right? But what we do understand is that it works. I don't know yes. how it works, right? I don't know how it works, but if you're having a bad day, if you are in India and if you had a bad day, you can just go to these ancient sites and you just forget about everything and like completely cleanse your mind of and get rid of all these negative thoughts. We know that it works, but we just don't know why it works or how it works.
Yes. I'm going to come back a little later to some of your spiritual experiences, which I'm very interested in. But before we get there, you mentioned earlier your trip to Indonesia, which is quite recent. And while you were there, you went to the Candi Suku Temple, which is an extraordinary place. And my jaw dropped when I saw you walk around this place because it really is an anomaly. It portrays long-skulled people, such as you might find in ancient Peru, the Paracca skulls, or in Egypt with the way some of the pharaohs were portrayed, with the false beard that was Egyptian fashion as well. You've got a portrayal of the Ark of the Covenant, it looks like, which is the Hebrew tradition, Hebrew scriptures. You've got a Mayan-style pyramid. I mean, it looks like a religious Disneyland, that it seems to be a theme park of world thought and world religion. That's a lot of cultural knowledge in one place. Now, I was interested to know, what is the date of that place for that knowledge all to have come together? Does it reflect an ancient global culture, or was this simply put together by someone who is very well traveled? What do you make of it? It's an extraordinary place. What do you make of it?
Thanks for watching. Click on the links in the description to watch the full video.